Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Well, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a terrific show for you today. Our guest is an award-winning journalist who's written extensively about media, politics, and pop culture, and is a contributing editor of Rolling Stone. He also writes frequently for the Huffington Post and is a former senior writer for Salon. He lives currently with his wife and two children in Montclair, New Jersey, and he's the author of a new book, which we'll be talking about on today's program, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. We welcome Eric Bollert to the air. Eric, you there?
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
I had a chance to read it over the last week, and in fact, I didn't get it from your publicist or from the press, but I got a copy sent to me by Bill Moyers, of all people.
Good.
And
good.
Bill
yeah.
was just raving about it and said it was a book I had to read, and he's absolutely right. It was a real pleasure to read, and for people interested in politics and media and current events, I can't give this book a high enough recommendation.
I appreciate it.
Well, let's just, for the sake of listeners who are unfamiliar with your work and with your book, Lapdogs, maybe just give, what's your core argument here?
The core argument is that there's been sort of this titanic shift in the way the press is covering the Bush administration as compared to the way it covered the Clinton administration, and specifically this sort of extreme timidity that's set in the press corps. And again, we see this the fear of the facts, ignoring the facts and sort of the fear of reporting them. And, you know, it goes from the WMD debacle to the Downing Street memo saga. And I have a whole chapter on the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and how the press completely fell down in sort of their fact-checking role. And again, how when the press falls down, it falls down and it benefits Bush. It almost never benefits Democrats, and we've seen the same cycle over and over. If you go back to the beginning, Clinton years, almost for 15 years now, and it's become, you know, it's not just a journalism problem, it's becoming a political problem, because for folks on the left and progressives and Democrats, you know, it's got to the point where, you know, it doesn't really matter what your message is if the press is not dealing with you in an even-handed and fair way. I mean, if you can't get a sort of a fair shake from the press and through that filter, the message doesn't matter. So, I think folks on the left need to come to the realization that, you know, the media are the issue, and we have to hold them to a higher standard and start getting them to treat Democrats the way they treat Republicans. I mean, it's a total double standard.
Eric Bollert, I'm a little bit confused, though, because, you know, I've been studying media for a long time, and I constantly hear about the liberal media who
right.
have it in for Republicans, who hate George W. Bush, who don't like evangelical Christians, who
right.
don't like the military or business,
right.
but
right.
are in love with feminazis and
right.
Labor unions. I'm having cognitive dissonance.
I know,
help me out
I know.
Here.
It's all very confusing. You know, my book really does pick up for Eric Alterman's great book, What Liberal Media Ended, that was in 2003, and he was the first, not the first, but he really stuck a knife in that argument, I think, and mine does it the same way, but focusing specifically on how the press is dealing with Bush. But yeah, you know, everyone knows this claim about the liberal media bias. I mean, the conservatives have been waging that war for going on 35 years now, and it's produced extraordinary benefits for the conservative movement. And it's worked, because I think you know, reporters and journalists have a real rabbit ears for that charge, and they bend over backwards to prove that they're not liberal. And you know, how do you do that during the Clinton years? Well, you know, you hype phony stories like Whitewater, and you talk about how Clinton's not authentic, and then you talk about how Gore is not authentic, and you depict Gore as sort of borderline psychopath. And how do you prove during the Bush years that you're not liberal? Well, you sort of revere this Republican power. You talk about how Bush doesn't pay attention to the polls and he's authentic and everyone wants to have a beer with him and he's a regular guy. So it's had a clear impact in the political dialogue, and the whole thing is a farce and the whole thing is phony in terms of that charge. as I point out, for 300 pages. But yeah, I mean, everyone knows it, and it's become this sort of conventional wisdom, and it's sort of this cliche, and the press doesn't fight back against the conservatives when they make that claim. So it's taken on a life of its own, and more importantly, it's had an extraordinary impact on how journalism is produced.
Our guest today on Media Matters again is Eric Bollert, author of the brand new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, published by Free Press. It's just been out for how long now, a couple months?
Middle of May, yeah, so just 5 or 6 weeks.
5 or 6 weeks. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Eric Bollert and talk about his new book, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You open the book with a great deal of irony by talking about the current work of Bob Woodward,
right,
and comparing it to how he cut his teeth 35 years ago and built his reputation. Talk a little bit about that for our listeners, if you would.
Yeah, it was. I opened the book dealing with Woodward's role in the Valerie Plame leak investigation, the special prosecutor trying to find out who inside the administration may have leaked the name of Valerie Plame because her husband was an anti-war critic. Obviously, Scooter Libby was later indicted for lying to a grand jury and lying to FBI during the course of that investigation. It was clearly the most important criminal investigation of the Bush administration, and it played out over between the fall of 2003 and then Libby was indicted in October of 2005. During that time, we knew that various reporters were involved, Matt Cooper at Time Magazine, Judith Miller at the New York Times, obviously Robert Novak, who first published the name of Valerie Plame, and a handful of other reporters, Tim Russer, got involved regarding information they may or may not have received from the White House. Again, you know, this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Judith Miller was eventually sent to prison for not cooperating. And lo and behold, you know, a week or 10 days after Scooter Libby was indicted, Bob Woodward announces, oh, by the way, I also got a leak about Valerie Plame. But he sat on the information for 2 years because he says it wasn't really that important. It was just sort of an offhand comment. So he sits on this bombshell for 2 years. But during those 2 years, he's also going on TV and sort of denigrating the special prosecutor, saying it's a waste of time, calling him a junkyard prosecutor. And so it's just sort of extraordinary. I mean, here's Bob Woodward, who, along with Carl Bernstein, you know, essentially, well, obviously broke the Watergate story and brought down the Nixon administration because they refused to go along with sort of the mainstream beltway feeling at the time that Watergate was just, you know, a second-rate burglary. I mean, they're the ones that stuck with it. They're the ones that chased after their sources. They're the ones that advanced that story for month after month for almost a year. And now here's Bob Woodward, who's a multimillionaire because of the access he gets for White House books that he writes, and he's in the process of writing a third book on the Bush administration. And he sits on this information for two years. While he's ridiculing the prosecutor. I mean, it's just, as I say in the book, I mean, he became the ultimate symbol of sort of watchdog to lapdog.
We're talking today to Eric Bollert on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Eric Bollert's the author of the brand new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over by Bush, just published by Free Press. If you'd like to call in and join us, the number here at Media Matters, WILL-AM 580, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Phone lines are already filling up, so let's go to the phones right away. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Eric Bollert.
I think you'd have a hard time making the charge that the media is liberal, as you sit on a liberal program on a publicly funded station. I'd also like to take into account that I would say 75% of the journalistic community probably voted against George Bush. There has to be some sort of congregation between the producer and what's produced. To say that the media is not liberal, I mean, that's pissing in the ocean, man.
Okay.
Well, that's the argument from people who don't understand journalism, don't respect journalism, and want journalism to go away. It's a complete myth created by the right wing that if you produce the journalism based on how you vote, It's a completely unprecedented, you know, accusation. And you know, do people cover the Board of Ed? Do people cover the environment? Do people cover labor? Do people cover sports, news, and entertainment based on how they vote? I mean, it's like going back to sort of this guilt by association, you know. You know, why don't we judge people by if they're Catholic or Jewish, because then, you know, or Protestant, and then we can decipher how they cover religion and how biased they are. I mean, it's obvious that... Hello?
The caller, I'm sorry.
Okay. So it's obvious that there have been surveys that show that a majority of people in newsrooms do vote Democratic. But two things about that. A, there's no barrier to Republicans or conservatives who want to become reporters. You know, a lot of people, kids graduate from college, and anyone can become a reporter in places like Champaign or Grand Rapids, and they can make $19,000 or $20,000 a year covering the Board of Ed and covering random murders. Anyone can do it. Why don't conservatives? Why don't young Republicans flock to, you know, become video assistants at the local TV station and make $10 an hour? You know, anyone can do it. They don't want to. That's up to them. Second point is, just because someone is a registered Democrat doesn't mean that that's how they produce, that's the journalism they produce. Again, I mean, that's an accusation made by people who've never been in journalism, don't understand journalism, don't respect journalism, and they want it to go away.
The score that I've seen about the proportion that vote Democratic as opposed to Republican in national elections. And, I mean, if it were the other way, if 90% or 80% of journalists in Washington voted Republican, I mean, you'd probably write about that in your book.
Yeah. But, you know, okay, the caller says, you know, it's impossible to say that, you know, the press isn't liberal. If the press is so anti-Bush, and if the press just gets up in the morning every day and just wants to nail Bush to the wall, you know, why did they ignore the Downing Street memo for an entire month? Why did virtually every major newspaper and every television network and cable news outlet for an entire month ignore a story that went straight to the heart of the question of how Bush, you know, lied the country into war? You can't make the argument that the press is out to get Bush, and then explain away how it ignored for an entire month, you know, the revelations that are in the Downing Street memo.
We're talking today to Eric Bollard, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. You know, let's follow up on this point, Eric, because in your book you talk at some length about Chris Matthews. His name appears throughout the book, in fact. And Tim Russert appears quite a bit as well. These are both prominent broadcast journalists. Now Russert hosting Meet the Press, Matthews with his own program on, I think it's MSNBC. And both of them come from the liberal Democratic backgrounds. Both have been associated with the Democratic Party in the past before going on network television and being liberals. Yet they do not come across in your book as propagandists on behalf of the left wing.
No, they as you're right, they both came from congressional backgrounds. But what's so important to understand about what happens in D.C. is that it's this obvious careerism that takes place, and there's an obvious culture. Matthews and Russert are both smart guys. They both have multi-million dollar contracts. They both have enormous vacation homes on Nantucket. I mean, they understand how the game is played. And the game is not played by going on TV and sounding like you're a congressional aide for Democratic leadership. The game is played by going on TV and you talk about how Democrats are in disarray, and you talk about how authentic Bush is, and you talk about... you know, what a genius Karl Rove is. And there's a question, I'll give you an example. If we go back to the 2000 campaign, in May of 2000, Boston Globe front page story by Walter Robinson completely spells out all the questions about Bush's National Guard service. The story is completely on the record, no anonymous sources, all quotes from Bush's commanders who say he'd failed to show up for a year. Front page Boston Globe. 5 days later, Chris Matthews scores an exclusive 60-minute interview with candidate George Bush, refuses to ask him a single question about why, according to the Boston Globe, who interviewed his commanders, why he refused to show up for duty for an entire year. I mean, Chris Matthews isn't dumb. He knows the story's out there. He knows he just scored this coup with George Bush. And he knows that he's not going to ask that question. I mean, that's just the way the game is played. And that is the culture of sort of this Beltway, sort of a very incestuous Beltway community.
You know, maybe to put a more little more amplification to these points, Eric Bullard, a lot of your book talks about, as you've already mentioned, the double standard that has existed in the coverage of the Bush administration to the coverage of the Clinton administration beforehand. Maybe give one or two examples, paired examples, of the sort of stories that were roughly similar factually but covered in dramatically different fashion for the two presidencies.
Yeah, the best – well, a good example is the first 2 years we talked about the Valerie Plame investigation, which in the end produced, you know, indictments of Scooter Libby. The most serious criminal investigation of the Bush administration. If you go back to the first 2 years of Whitewater, which resulted in no criminal activities of anyone associated with the Clinton administration, the first 2 years, when it was just a real estate deal, had nothing to do with Monica Lewinsky or anything like that. The first 2 years, ABC's Nightline devoted 19 entire nights over 2 years to Whitewater. The first 2 years of the Valerie Plame investigation, Nightline devoted three programs. So that gives you a pretty good look. Nightline thought Whitewater as a real estate deal was wildly important. 19 programs. They thought the investigation, which resulted in the criminal felony charges for a very senior Bush administration official, was almost irrelevant, and almost over 2 years gave it no coverage.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Eric Bullard, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, just published by Free Press. If you'd like to call in with a question for Eric Bullard, the number here at Media Matters on WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Greetings.
Good afternoon. This is sort of ripped from the airwaves. Mr. Bullard, you were just cited on the show. Well, actually, it aired here on the media. And you were cited as saying, the press has already said that the Democrats lost the strategy of arguing about the war because cut and run is so pervasively and such a great slogan, actually, I guess, if you want to boil it down. And you were saying, if you look at the polls, most people believe that we should leave expeditiously, and you were cited, but I wanted you to comment just on that general idea. It's too late for your book, but then I was struck by the next segment, and this sort of undermines the idea that even to the media out of New York is somehow liberal. They had a long segment with the New Yorker's Washington correspondent Jeffrey Goldberg talking about the efficacy of this speechwriter who just left the Bush administration. I'm forgetting his name, but you know who he is.
Gerson. Michael Gerson.
Yeah, Goldberg. Goldberg, helped start the war at the New Yorker, and I don't know if you spent any time on him, but he had an article called which absolutely tied Al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein. It was amazing. I'm particularly struck by this because Remick, the editor, nominal editor of the New Yorker, doesn't even apparently read his own paper because he denied publishing anything that tied Al-Qaeda to the Iraq situation.
Yeah.
I have one more point to make on Remick, and then I'll bail out, which is he was on To the Point out of Boston, and I had to listen to this twice on the replay. Anybody can go to this interview with him on the archives of WBUR Boston. Somebody called him up and challenged him, what about overthrowing Saddam Hussein? What about overthrowing somebody in the past like Pinochet? And Remick actually said that Pinochet was an elected leader. I mean, the fellow is ignorant of history. He doesn't read his own paper, and this is the New Yorker. I'm just, you know, I better go. Thank you.
Well, it's a good thing we're non-commercial because we won't be getting any ads from the New Yorker.
That's right. The point about Jeffrey Goldberger is a good one. He, you know, had one of the he's one of these neocon writers, and supposedly had this big scoop. I think it was 203 about, you know, how actually Saddam and Al Qaeda were connected, and you know, the whole thing went nowhere. But it was treated as incredibly important and incredibly insightful at the time. A larger point about that is, I point out in my book, you know, I don't think this country could have gone to war, or I don't think Bush could have convinced the country to go to war if it didn't have the help of the so-called liberal media. The New Yorker is a perfect example. I mean, there were some notable exceptions, but they essentially signed on for the war. Obviously, the Washington Post editorial page, I think I counted 28 pro-war editorials between October 2002 and March 2003. I think every columnist, almost, maybe except E.J. Dionne, signed off on that war. The New Republic, Newsweek, Time. I mean, the whole East Coast, you know, up and down the East Coast. I mean, every important mainstream media outlet that's considered liberal, editors and key columnists signed off on that war. Because I think, frankly, journalists like a lot of Democrats were sort of looking for cover and didn't want to be exposed. In terms of the cut and run, you know, that was the narrative last week, that the Republicans had the upper hand on the war resolution debate. The Senate was debating a couple resolutions put forward by Democrats putting a timetable on troop withdrawal. And the mainstream press, the clear narrative of the week, were Democrats were on retreat. They were on the wrong side of this issue. Republicans felt like they had their footing back. A lot of quotes about, you know, the cut and run, and a lot of quotes about how the Democrats are on the wrong side of this issue. What the press absolutely ignored is the polls that showed, as the caller mentioned, every poll taken, virtually every poll taken in the last 3 months, shows the majority of Americans want a timetable for troop withdrawal. So here are the Democrats embracing the policy issue that a majority of Americans accept, and the press depicts Democrats as the one being in the box, and press depicts Democrats as the one playing defense, and the press depicts the Republicans on a roll. You know, as I wrote, apparently if Karl Rove sort of unfurls a strategy, that the press assumes it's an act of genius. So if the Republicans decided they're going to run for re-election on the war in Iraq, that the press decides it's genius, and they've outplayed Republicans again, despite the fact, I mean, I think we're up to 60% now who think the war was a mistake. And one of the NBC polls had it something like 52-37 Americans thought we should set a timetable for withdrawal. So I just found it, you know, yet another example of really how the press just sort of adopts the, you know, the sort of the RNC talking points and refuses to deal with reality, which in terms of the troop withdrawal in Iraq was Democrats were completely in step with the majority of Americans, and yet the Democrats were depicted as the one being outmaneuvered by Republicans.
Eric Bollert, I'm wondering, you know, we often talk about on this show, and I think it's a common refrain among liberals and progressives, disappointment that the Democratic Party isn't more of an opposing force to the Republicans and to Bush, that they don't stake out a firmer identity in opposition on the war and on a host of other issues. Based on your research and looking at lapdogs, how much of Democratic Party timidity and timidity of Democratic politicians is due to the fact that they will get such little support in the media that if they do take a strong position against Bush, they think they're going to get sort of sliced and diced by the Chris Matthews of the world?
Well, I think the timidity is a good point, and I think there's an absolute legitimate criticism. Not only I think Democrats will not take on Bush strongly, although I think they're doing that now, I think the Democrats won't take the press on strongly. And if Democrats want to see any effective change, they're going to have to start taking on the press. That doesn't mean beating up on the press like folks on the right do, and they do it in an incredibly dishonest way, you know, sort of making up allegations about the press and specific stories or things like that. But they're going to have to start not fearing the press. But going back to the other point, even when they do take on Bush, you know, this Washington press has just essentially dismiss the Democratic voice. I mean, obviously, Republicans control the House and the White House and the courts. But I'll give you an example. You know, again, back to the Downing Street memo.
Maybe just for a little background.
I'll spell it out.
This
was a memo that was published May 1st, 2005 by the Times in London. It was a memo written to Tony Blair. The memos of a meeting. Minutes of a meeting that was held at Tony Blair's 10 Downing Street residence with all his senior officials discussing the pending war and discussing a recent trip his senior defense and diplomatic officials had had from Washington. This is the summer of 2002, 8 months before the war. They reported to Blair that Bush had decided to go to war. Not that the United States was planning to go to war, had decided to go to war. Intelligence was being fixed around the purpose of the war. The administration saw its job as essentially selling the war, and if they did go to the UN, it would not be to try to avoid the war, but try to trap Saddam into to triggering a war. Essentially, you know, incredibly important because it just sort of obliterated all the rhetoric that Bush had been using, that, you know, he didn't want to go to war and that he hadn't made up his mind. And the whole notion that the Blair and his government knew months before the war that the intelligence was being fixed. You know, any way you look at it, it's a story. You could argue whether it was on page one or A14, but it is a story, and it was completely ignored. Cable, network, magazines, newspapers. Only 5 weeks later, the mainstream press was forced to deal with it only because of sort of talk radio and online. But here's my point about Democrats. During that month, I was told by a Democratic staffer, and at the time, 100 Democratic members of Congress wrote to the White House demanding, you know, answers to questions about the Downing Street memo. Democratic staffers worked every news bureau in Washington for a month trying to get them to deal with the Downing Street memo, and for a month they refused to do it. So I agree Democrats have to be more aggressive against Bush, but here's a case where they were desperately trying to get the story out, and the mainstream media just looked at them like, go away. We have no interest in what you have to say, and we're not going to treat you seriously. And they've been doing that to Democrats for 5 or 6 years.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Eric Bollert, the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, just published by Free Press. Eric Bollert is an award-winning journalist who's written extensively about media and politics. He writes for Rolling Stone and the Huffington Post and is a former senior editor for Salon. It's a pleasure to have him on the show. Our phone number here, if you have a question or comment for Eric Bollert, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are full, and I'm going to get back to the calls in 1 second. But first, let me say that the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be on the road in Norway, the old country, enjoying life there. And we're going to have recorded shows for you with Anthony Arnov next week. And 2 weeks from today, we'll have Robert Jensen on the air. So please stay tuned for those shows. You've just completed recording them. I think you'll enjoy them. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Eric Bollert.
Good morning. I hope you have a good time, Dr. McChesney.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm a big fan of the show, you know, but this morning I was listening to Madeleine Albright on CNN, Wolf Blitzer, and she was responding to comments earlier by Hamid Karzai from Afghanistan talking about the situation there, and she wanted to make the point that this country was completely misdirected by going to Iraq and not going after terrorists in Afghanistan. At the same time I listen to that, I want to scream because as mentioned a little earlier, the links between al-Qaeda and Hussein are nebulous. But also, I mean, thinking that the terrorists came from Afghanistan to begin with is questionable. They came from Saudi Arabia, to my knowledge, Egypt and other places, but maybe not Afghanistan, possibly linked to Osama bin Laden. But even he in earlier days had said that he wasn't related to that. And what I'm getting to is there's so much talent. There's so many great words and books coming out about the problems with the press. Robert Perry, for instance, always talking about how Democrats should come up with their own think tanks and an alternative to the right's control of the press today. The Nation had a great essay this week about the death of the press in America, of the media in America, how it's completely consolidated over these past years. This is so frustrating. I know it's frustrating to everybody who cares about the press, the media, you, everyone, Mr. Bollard, everyone. But I it's my opinion that we missed the elephant in the room from the very beginning. It goes back to the 9/11. It goes back to the Twin Towers coming down. It goes back to the facts. And everyone has run from it, not wishing to discuss it or the facts. And I'm just curious what Mr. Bollard thinks about that. Everyone, it seems some of the most thoughtful people in America, including Noam Chomsky, others, seem to think that the world's problems are so great that that's trivial. But to me, that was the cause of that's why a feckless idiot president, a president who wasn't elected, and we know that's another thing, the election system, but he was given a carte blanche to do whatever he wants, and now he's taking away our freedoms. And every day, I turn on the TV this morning. I seldom watch TV, but I was absolutely shocked by the things I heard from the talking heads, whether I was on whatever station I turned to. I know you all have similar feelings, but I want to express that I believe that it's time more and more people started looking into these things. And speaking of poll numbers, huge numbers of people want to know the truth. They don't, at least they don't believe the official 9/11 Commission report. And I think serious journalists, instead of saying, okay, well, this is something we don't want to endanger our careers by looking as if we've got tinfoil hats or whatever, you know, we won't discuss this. We're going to nip at the heels of the problem instead of attack it head on.
Robert, why don't we let Eric Bollard answer that now?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your call. Yeah, the 9/11 attack, what did, the sort of analysis of why that took place and how that took place, how what grade would you give the press corps for that?
Well, I think the caller might be talking about something else entirely. I mean, I think he might be talking about a larger reason of what actually happened. There's people who don't agree with the 9/11 Commission, but I'm not the best person to address that. But in the larger sense of the 9/11 analysis, well, I don't know. I mean, the 9/11 Commission itself, you know, I don't think that the press did a great job. I mean, if it wasn't for those four women from New Jersey, I think the whole commission would have been swept under the rug, and the press would have been more than willing to let it happen. I thought they were sort of embarrassed by the 9/11, the families who were the ones who prodded that into existence. On a much larger scale, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about the timidity in the press with Bush, they say, they point to 9/11 and the war in Iraq and say, well, it's almost understandable, you know, our nation is attacked and then we invade another country, that the press is going to sort of retreat and play its cards closer to the vest and get a little nervous during times of patriotic fervor. But I don't think that explains it, because I think Bush got some of his softest coverage in 2005. You know, 4 years after the attacks of 9/11 and 2 years after the invasion. So, you know, I do think the 9/11 and the war had something to do with this sort of rampant timidity, but those two events in and of themselves, I don't think explain what something, I don't think they explain the larger phenomena.
Our guest today, Eric Bollard. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Eric Bollard.
Hi, Eric. I go up to Canada fairly regularly, and I have been to England a number of times, and I'm very impressed by the CBC and the BBC. Not very impressed by the British tabloids, but I am, you know, the CBC and BBC not perfect, but they do a good job. I'd like to hear your comments on commercial media versus non-commercial and how much of our problem in America is caused by the fact that all these news organizations, except NPR, of course, are commercial organizations.
And before you answer that, if I can add in, Eric, you do have a chapter on PBS in the book. You might want to talk a little bit about that, too.
Yeah, there is a whole chapter on PBS and sort of the war that the conservatives waged against PBS yet again when Kenneth Tomlinson was head of the CPB, which is sort of the umbrella organization that doles out tens of millions of dollars. Tomlinson became sort of the point man for this ongoing conservative crusade against public broadcasting and how it had a liberal bias and how he was going to fix it, and how Bill Moyers had to be, there had to be a counterweight. So then he went over and lobbied, the Wall Street Journal to give them their own show, the right-wing editorial page, which was a flop and is now on Fox. And I point out about how Tomlinson went on this, crusade, and despite the fact that the CPB had done polling of its own, hired a Republican and a Democratic firm to look at perceptions of public broadcasting among Americans who watch and among Americans who don't. And Tomlinson was clearly fishing for some evidence of a liberal bias, and he couldn't find it in either one of the polling that they did, which is why they didn't release it for at least a year. The problem with public broadcasting in America is that they're under constant attack from Republicans. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw again. It's like, flag-burning amendment. I mean, it comes up every year. Every year they announce they're going to cut, I think it was over $100 billion for public broadcasting. And, you have to understand the money that's set aside for public broadcasting would fuel the Pentagon, I think, for about 4 hours, literally, 4 hours of one day. And that's all the money that's set aside for public broadcasting. And every year it's under constant attack. So I think there is a chill on public broadcasting, on PBS and NPR, and that they don't want to, give Republicans any ammunition. So the problem with the public broadcasting in America is that it's not hands-off, and they sort of operate under a cloud that I certainly don't think the CBC in Canada or the BBC has that same kind of political ramifications. Obviously, both those have oversight, and both those have to broadcast the highest standards of journalism. But I don't think either one of those news organizations is constantly fighting off this sort of rear attack by Republicans, who really essentially just want to do away with public broadcasting.
And is it the
just like Richard Nixon wanted to do away with it in 1973. I mean, it's this never-ending.
I mean, is that based, in your view, on like an implicit belief that commercial media supported by advertising, owned by corporations, is more likely to generate a journalism that's sympathetic to Republican politics?
Well, I think it has in the last 15 years. I think absolutely. Again, I think that goes more to the culture, the Beltway culture, and the careerism involved. Two things: consolidations, fewer people. With the massive consolidations, we've seen huge cutbacks in newspaper television over the last 10 years. So if you're a political reporter in Washington, you look around, you realize, if something happened to your job, there's not that many other options, places to go. So you don't want anything to happen to your job. You don't want to, you don't want to rock the boat, and so everyone sort of adheres to this, narrative about Democrats and Republicans. So I think commercial broadcasters, or specifically television, they've certainly shown a bias towards Republicans, I think, in the last 10 years.
Our guest today, Eric Bohler. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a comment on, and this may be a short comment, actually, in terms of the press corps. And the other one, the previous caller, I think, was getting at when the 9/11 is, this point of why do they hate us? Well, there was no historical perspective that was taken on that. you know, that kind of thing. Maybe this is the issue. So I'll just go off the air and listen.
Okay. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that I think is true. I mean, I mean, if we just go back to the Clinton years when Clinton ordered that botched bombing of what was supposed to be a chemical or mustard factory for Al-Qaeda. Where was that? The Sudan?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was the coverage? The entire coverage was, you know, did he do this because of the impeachment? Did he do this to try to turn the, you know, change the topic in Washington? Did he do this for political purposes? Republicans claimed, you know, it was all for political purposes. There was very little actual coverage of what Al-Qaeda was, who bin Laden was, what the force, you know, what the threat to America was. You know, when foreign policy was covered by the mainstream media, you know, 1998 to 2000, it was almost not entirely, but, you know, a huge threat of that was, how does this relate to impeachment? How does this relate to Monica Lewinsky? Is this good for Clinton in the polls or bad for Clinton in the polls? I think the press did a very poor job explaining what this mounting threat was, you know, even after the coal was bombed in 2000. Just not enough serious foreign policy coverage.
Eric Bollert, you know, in the last month or so, President Bush, whose ratings have been, you know, plummeting over the past 18 months and I think have gotten rather low by historical standards for a second-term president or any president for that matter, the press has been talking about his rebound and his
right.
bounce back, and
right.
Fox News and all the cable news are filled with stories about this. How does this coverage compare to Bill Clinton during his second term?
Well, Bill Clinton during his second term, I wrote a piece for Huffington Post this week, and all this, two things about this sort of Bush bounce chatter, which was incessant on the, particularly on the cable shows after they finally got Zarqawi and Karl Rove was cleared and a couple other things. I mean, it was just a classic example of, you know, the Republican talking points are Bush is on a rebound, and then, you know, particularly the pundits on TV, but even the print and radio guys, I mean, they can't stop repeating the talking points. And what was extraordinary is, like, CNN, I saw a couple reports. I mean, Anderson Cooper devoted entire segments to, will Bush get a bounce? So it wasn't that they were so anxious. They just wanted to talk about if this would happen. I mean, typically in the past, if you're talking about presidential polling 6 years into a term, you don't do entire segments on, you know, are his polls going to go up or down? You wait till it happens, and then you do a story. But it was just so forced, so spoon-fed from the RNC that everyone was sort of scrambling about, you know, best week for Bush in 2 years. Well, it turns out if you look at the polls, I think his collective jump was 2 points, which is almost comical. At this
point. Within the margin of error.
Yeah, and I pointed out at Huffington Post, you know, will someone please put this in perspective? I mean, he would have needed a 25-point jump to get where Bill Clinton was at this point in his second term. I mean, it's comical. You know, all this chatter about his polls, but everyone was very careful to point out where was Bush in the polls. He was an historically unpopular president. I mean, he's if he doesn't get out of the 40s this summer, he will pass Richard Nixon for the longest consecutive streak of months with sub-40 approval ratings of any president in modern history. I mean, he is an historically unpopular president, and the press just refuses to talk about that. And one other quick anecdote. When 4 months into Bush, Clinton's first term, you remember he had a very rocky transition, and he couldn't find an attorney general, and everyone in the Beltway was sort of chuckling about how these people from Arkansas couldn't find their way around. Clinton had very low approval ratings. He got down to 43% in the spring of 93. Washington Post did this big feature, mocking feature, and the headline was "Another Failed President?" And that's when Bush was at. That's when Clinton was at 43%. This year, we've seen Bush down to 31%. In the Washington Post, last time I checked, had never even used the phrase "failed presidency." In relation to George Bush.
Our guest, Eric Bollert, you're listening to Media Matters. We've got time for a couple more callers, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Bollert, factored into your, I think, totally justified criticism of mainstream media, is there a situation where the mainstream commentators still can't get over the fact that even though they are in effect cooperating, the Republicans still hold them in bitter contempt.
Yeah. I talk in the book about this love-hate relationship. I mean, the Republicans in the White House hate the press, and the press loves this Republican White House. I mean, it's this total, you know, hit me one more time. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. They do hold them in complete contempt, and we haven't talked about this. It's important. I mean, Bush came with a very aggressive pushback agenda. I mean, he was essentially going to walk away from press conferences. Bush's chief of staff famously called the press corps just another special interest group seeking access. They've subpoenaed reporters like no other administration in history. They invite someone like Jeff Gannon into the White House press briefings.
And you write about that in your book at some length.
Yeah, you know, this is a former male escort who has absolutely no legitimate press credentials, and he's waved into the White House something like 200 visits, never forced to submit to an FBI check like every other reporter in that room, basically. They're paying off pundits like Armstrong Williams and Maggie Gallagher. I mean, by the 2005, they've sort of run out of ways to try to humiliate the press. And how does the press react? Well, you know, kick me again. I mean, let's look at that surprise trip to Baghdad. They get everyone in the press pool. They don't tell them where they're going. They get on the plane, and they fly to Baghdad. And, you know, it's obviously a huge hit on the cable shows and nonstop. And there's a little aside, and one of the reporters in charge of the press pool that day are saying, well, you know, that's not the way it's supposed to work. You know, they're supposed to tell us, and we can keep a secret. And you know, darn it, this has happened before. You know, this is six years into the administration, and they keep waiting for the administration to, like, play fair with them or show some respect. And it's never going to happen, but it doesn't matter because they realize, you know, they just keep kicking them and they just keep rolling over.
Eric Bollert, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over Bush, is our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple callers I want to get to before the show's over. But before we do, I want you to talk really briefly, if you would, Eric, about the Swift boat controversy in 2004 in the presidential election, because it's an important part of your book, and I want you to sort of give your a summation of your critique.
Yeah. I do an entire chapter, and it's not, you know, the point of the chapter is not to go back and rehash, you know, gosh, where was John Kerry, although in effect I do indirectly. The point is to look at the press coverage and to show how it was a complete breakdown in the traditional fact-checking, truth-telling role that the press plays, particularly during a national campaign. And, you know, these are guys that came for 35 years after the fact, didn't have a single document to support their allegations that John Kerry faked his war wounds and won fraudulent medals. Some of them had publicly changed their position regarding Kerry in Vietnam just 2 or 3 years earlier. It was a dirty trick. It was a hoax. It was a fraud. That's what it was. And yet, for the entire month of August 2004, you know, most members of the press sort of threw up their hands. And, you know, they said, fog of war, you know, we may never know what John Kerry did in Vietnam. You know, the point is U.S. Navy knows exactly what John Kerry did in Vietnam because they've got his records. No one's ever disputed the records. And the press, I think, was absolutely terrified of calling the Swift boat allegations out for what they were, which was a Republican dirty trick, because they knew the extraordinary firestorm that would have created. So they just sort of essentially played dumb.
Now, how about the argument that Dan Rather showed his liberal credentials by pushing this story?
Right, good point. So August 2004, Swift boat, you know, demoralizes or flattens John Kerry's campaign. September 2004, the CBS botched report, which absolutely is a huge help to the Bush campaign. If, you know, you see sort of a pattern here. CBS clearly botched that. They could not authenticate the memos. They shouldn't have used the memos, because I argue I have a whole separate book, a separate chapter on Bush and the National Guard. And again, from the perspective of how the press deals with it, those memos were essentially irrelevant. They were a nice prop. TV loves props and something they can put on the screen. They're essentially, they gave it sort of an emotional story or a personal story. It was memo supposedly written by Bush's commander expressing his frustration about, you know, why Bush hadn't been showing up and hadn't shown up for his physical and things like that. CBS could have thrown those memos in the trash, probably where they belong, and they could have aired a 20-minute segment on why Bush never showed up for the National Guard, but they didn't, and they did, I think, screw it up and opened up a huge floodgate. But you know, it doesn't. I don't think that episode showed Dan Rather's liberal bias. I think it showed he had a good news instinct because it was a legitimate story. But after CBS got into that controversy, you know, the rest of the press just really headed for the hills.
Cut and ran.
One other quick point. People always say, gosh, you know, how come, why are journalists so timid, and don't, aren't they naturally ambitious by design, and don't they want to make a name for themselves, and can't they do that by breaking some stories on Bush? Well, yeah, look at Dan Rather. I mean, he screwed up on a Bush story. His career is over. That show was canceled. They fired several senior news executives. I mean, I think the message was sent pretty clear. If you do a story that's critical of Bush and you screw up, you know, there's a scorched earth policy in terms of repercussions. I'm still looking for a single reporter during the Clinton years who was ever fired or reprimanded for making stuff up about Whitewater.
Okay, we've only got a minute or so left. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, if you could very quickly give your question, please.
Great. CBS memos. Everyone has also ignored the fact that the same person who said the memos were fake also said that their contents were true. And I wanted to say quickly what to speak of the Valerie Plame thing. The whole coverage of the Conyers impeachment hearings has been completely ignored. And then in regards to the recently civil disobedience of the actual members of Congress on two occasions, one I think was Sudan and the other I think something to do with the war, if you could say anything about that. And I also wanted to ask you quickly if you've heard of Out There TV and your opinion of that, because they seem to be breaking stories months before anybody else. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry, what was it? Have I heard of?
Something TV, I confess. I didn't catch it either.
Okay, I'm sorry to miss it either.
But, you know, we're winding out of time, Eric Bullard, so I just want to give you a chance to say, you know, how has your press coverage been for the book?
entirely predictable, which is the mainstream press has very little interest in dealing with this. Some of the reviews we've got, I think, have been sort of head-scratching. We got a Washington Post review a couple Sundays ago, Slate, New York Observer, things like that. The reviewers really seem to be straining to not deal with what's in the book. They seem to be sort of writing around the edges and just not wanting to deal with what's in the book. The Washington Post.
Eric Bullard, unfortunately, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background. I've got to thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thanks
Eric
for having
Bullard,
me.
The author of Lapdogs, Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 1 week. Thank you.